Welcome to Audio Gyan with Kedar Nimkar, a podcast that documents insightful conversations with Indian designers, artists, musicians, writers, thinkers, and creatives of all types. Here's your host, Kedar Nimkar.
This week, Audio Gyan turns 4. On this anniversary episode, I would like to thank all listeners for tuning in and all the guests who have spent their valuable time and effort for the show. This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service showcasing exceptional films from around the globe. Get a whole month free at mubi.com/audiogyan. Well, we have 3 films on Mubi made by our today's guest, Right Here, Right Now, The Continuum, and one exclusively on Mubi, which is The Insignificant Man. Yes, we are celebrating this episode, which is the 4th anniversary with Anand Gandhi. I'm super thrilled and excited, and at the same time, a bit nervous to have Anand on the show. I'm just going to introduce him for the record, in case this audio is found maybe 100, 200 years out in the future. And actually, it's also a challenge to introduce great minds like him. I would simply call him a philosopher, filmmaker, explorer, game designer. And I refer to him as one of the most important thinkers of our time. So thanks, Anand, for giving your time. It's a real honor to have you on Audio Gyan.
Thank you, Kedar, to have me, and thank you for your very kind words.
Yeah. So frankly, I'm my expertise or the domain knowledge, any area you pick, is not as developed enough to ask any questions, but I have genuine 2 questions. One is broadly about when I first saw you live in one of the talks, you mentioned about a Zen proverb. I wanted to ask you about that. Has your definition changed over time about that? Because it has completely changed my perspective to life. And the second one is the cognitive gym, which you've been talking about in the recent videos that I saw. If you can start by telling me what's the cognitive gym, how essential is it?
I think it's really the most exciting project I've been working on for the last few years to really find this tool or rather a toolbox of a set of techniques and hacks and tricks and exercises that make the process of expanding your consciousness, that make the process of enlightening yourself, the process of really grasping the nature of reality, the relationship that the individual human has with their environment, accessible to all. And the cognitive gym is really one such, is really the paradigm for this entire toolbox. Now, I've given a lot of examples elsewhere. I'm going to repeat some of these examples, assuming that people who are coming to this conversation today have not necessarily seen these examples that I've given elsewhere. So let me jump right into giving some stories, into giving a couple of anecdotes from the environment, from nature. So let's talk about... Let's look at an experiment conducted a couple of decades ago by a behavioral scientist called Tinbergen. Now, within an hour of emerging from its shell, a herring gull chick starts looking for its mother's beak, which is usually a large yellow colored beak with a big red dot on it. The chick starts pecking at it, demanding to be fed. Now, in this very famous experiment, the Nobel Prize winning ethologist Tinbergen presented a seagull chick with a disembodied beak of an adult herring gull. The chick still pecked at the beak, expecting to be fed by the beak, notwithstanding the fact that there was no bird attached to it. So Tinbergen inquired into this further. He isolated a recipe of sorts, a visual recipe with the visual ingredients, and created a synthetic beak, so to say, a rectangular elongation, tapering thinness, high visual contrast between the dot and the base color of the beak, the red dot that was replaceable with dots of other colors, he realized later, as long as the contrast was maintained. Now, with slight exaggerations of this visual recipe, he made a fake beak and offered this fake object to the herring gull children. And they pecked at it even more excitedly. Not only did they peck at it, remember, they pecked at it with greater excitement than they were pecking at their mother's beaks.
When the contrast was exaggerated.
When the contrast was exaggerated, when the size of the dot was bigger, when the base of the beak was broader and the end was more tapering, any of these ingredients, when they were amplified, against one another, and hence the contrasts of these ingredients were amplified. Not only did the chicks continue pecking at these objects, they pecked at these objects with even further greater excitement. And every time he would amplify it, the chicks would get more and more excited. They would be hyper excited in their pecking. Each passing generation of amplification, they would peck at it with unprecedented wild enthusiasm.
Did the experiment involve also just aesthetically improving or functionally improving also?
There was no function. The beaks had no function whatsoever. These objects did not feed the children. The object did not carry any kind of a robotic mechanism to feed the chicks. There was absolutely zero or negative function, in fact. These were just synthetic toys, if anything. And as it turns out, the toy beak was far more exciting for the chick than its own mother, who would otherwise actually feed the chick at the end of it. So let's take another example that I give very often, which is male barn swallows. The barn swallow is a bird a little bigger than a sparrow, and they have light reddish brown chests. They have slightly maroon chests. And the females of the species prefer ones with greater color intensity. In barn swallows, this is an indication of genetic fitness. Now, in a study, scientists darkened the chests of previously rejected males with a felt tip marker. Males who were rejected by females in their region because their feathers were pale were darkened with a felt tip marker by these scientists. And this simple cosmetic hack made them instant hits with the females. They were suddenly producing more progeny. They were suddenly attracting more females than ever before. Let's study another example. Another example that I share very often, which is Juldimorpha beetles, bejeweled beetles, which have been observed attempting to copulate with beer bottles, mistaking the beer bottles called the stubbies thrown in their environment by humans, mistaking them for the most attractive female beetles ever. They find these bottles because of tubercles on these bottles, they find these bottles more attractive than the most attractive females around them. Now, what is really going on in these examples? What is exactly going on in the herring gull or the barn swallows or the beetles, right? Let's think about what's going on. Data and algorithms to process data are resource intensive. You look at any computing system in the world, right? What are the two most resource expensive objects in a computer? Data, right, and software and the processing power that the software takes, right? They are resource intensive even in biology.
Correct.
So life has evolved to optimize the little storage space and processing energy with highest fitness results. So stimuli needed to recognize and engage in life sustaining actions of eating, of feeding, of finding mating partners, of attracting mating partners, of conducting all kinds of actions that will sustain life, have evolved to have a unique to species fingerprinting system. Because if you had to process all data around you all the time, you'd never have that much energy. So instead of processing all the data all the time, you process fingerprint data. You look out for fingerprints. Like in the herring gull, the fingerprint in that case is the dot on the beak or the specific kind of shape that the beak takes, right? So it's enough for the herring gull chick to recognize the moving dot. It doesn't need to store information about an entire bird.
Correct. And that's how even we try to practice unit economics? Is it different?
That's how we practice everything in our life. Now think about barn swallows with a felt tip marker and think about makeup. Why is it that makeup works? The fact that makeup works should tell us something about how we respond to stimuli. The fact that the males of our species can produce six packs on their abs, or females can make
the lips look much brighter. Yeah,
lips look more saturated, more red, or cheeks look redder with blush, and that would have an actual impact and response towards the gender that they are trying to attract, and not only that, in humans, it becomes more complex. In humans, fertility and science of fertility are also used for creating kinships and peer relationships. So women may not care about attracting male partners, but may care about participating in a discourse of kinship, may want to create a sense of belonging or peerhood with other females and could use makeup towards that purpose. But the fact that we use stimuli and we can apply stimuli to our bodies to produce effects that are not very dissimilar from the way the felt tip marker on the chest of the male barn swallow produces experiential behavioral responses in the female of the species, or the way the Juldimorpha beetle gets attracted to the bottle, or the way the Heringal chicks get hacked by synthetic toys. It's not different at all from the way humans respond to stimuli, to synthetic stimuli around them. And that really is the fundamental premise behind our relationship with all our modern environments, from not just the most obvious ones, not just makeup and pornography and cinema, and not just toys and merchandise, but also subtler behavioral stimuli like kinship signaling in politics. In politics, politicians try to give you a sense of belonging and create an evil other for you to hate. Politicians create a sense of, not good politicians, but politicians who want to rule by dividing people, give you an easy kin to identify with and give you an easy other to hate. Now, these are behavioral stimuli that have evolved in forest and savanna environments for very specific purposes and can now be used to hack into our behaviors in a way that is very similar to the way we can hack into the behavior of a female barn swallow by putting a felt tip marker on the chest of a male barn swallow. What is really going on here? Let's kind of dial back a little bit now that I've given you a couple of examples about this.
Actually, one quick question.
Sure.
What you're talking is all at a level or at a plane of instinct, right? I don't know, but instinct seems to be very primordial in our nature. So we are talking about only that, or there's some evolved sense when we introduce imagination and these sort of concepts?
There is. You can retrain your instinct. You can retrain your... And that is really what the process of civility and the process of enlightenment is, to constantly retrain our instincts. But before we try to solve a problem, we ought to understand the problem. And that is really what we need to do. So before we form that cognitive gym, we need to understand why do we need to enter that cognitive gym in the first place. So this is the premise for understanding that.
Super. Okay, continue, please. Yeah.
So humans evolved in an environment and resource economy that is very different from the modern life of most individuals and groups today. We evolved in forest and savanna environments. So challenges involved in hunting and gathering led to the evolution of calorie consumption incentivization, calorie conservation and accumulation strategies, which basically means that because food was extremely hard to find in forest and savanna environments, hunting was difficult, gathering was insufficient always, our bodies evolved to reward any kind of calorie consumption and also reward any kind of calorie conservation. And that's why our bodies store all the calories, that try to store as many calories as it consumes. And our body also rewards us for eating more, because we evolved in environments where the food that we gathered was very rare and hunting was even a rarer opportunity. The scarcity of mating partners led to evolution of partner retention strategies, signaled by warning signals like jealousy and aggression, right? In the birthplace of humanity, 250,000 years ago, the total population on the planet, the total human Homo sapien population on the planet was in a couple of thousands. So there, because mating partners were always scarce, life evolved to have behaviors like jealousy and aggression. Jealousy is the behavior that signals potential loss of partner. And through that potential loss of partner signaling, we produce partner retention strategies. We find all kinds of methods and ways to stop our partners from being lost to us. But in an environment of partner and resource abundance, which is the environment that we're living in today, these may just be a set of vestigial responses. So the software that evolved in the scarcity of Stone Age is now being applied in the affluence of network age. That's the biggest problem in front of us as a species. First, let's understand the problem very clearly, that we come from a place of profound scarcity and we live in a place of profound abundance. We come from a place where there were 5,000 human beings and mating partners were scarce 250,000 years ago. Today, there are 7 billion of us do not necessarily face a scarcity of mating partners, and having more children is not the most important challenge in front of our species, right? So the real challenge in front of our species is how to ensure that opportunities to a dignified life and longevity and well-being are available to all humans. These complex problems are far more important and urgent than the problems that we evolved to solve as a species, which is how to get food and how to get a mating partner. So while scientific, social, and technological evolutions have led to augmented environments of abundance, certainty, comfort, and longevity for a large number of human beings, the gap between the body's biological expectation of the environment and the actual environment has never been wider. Our body expects real scarcity in our environment, but our actual environment, for most of us at least, provides certainty, comfort, and longevity. Because of technology, because of politics, because of living in most human beings are alive today in nation states that have some kind of a constitution and law enforcement. So their fundamental rights are not going to be stolen from them very easily. And hence, there is greater certainty of life. There is greater access that most human beings have today to food than ever before. And greater access that most human beings have towards finding mating partners than ever before. So our body expects scarcity at every level. And our body is confronted with abundance at multiple levels. So from junk food to pornography, from fake plastic trees to art and design, from resource and mating partner certainty to the lack of injury proneness, from dark concrete walls to fully lit nights, from sports to politics, our environment is laced with supernormal stimuli. The equivalent of the beer bottle stubs for the Beatles, or the equivalent of felt tip markers for herring gulls, the equivalent of the beak toys equivalent of felt tip markers for barn swallows and the equivalent of
beak toys for the toys herring
for the herring gull. We see these supernormal stimuli in every part of our environment, in junk food, in plastic decoration, in mating partners certainty, we don't have injury proneness as much as we would face it in our natural environments. We have dark concrete walls and our nights are fully lit. So our experience of light is extremely different from what our bodies are designed to respond to, from sports to politics. So we have built an augmented world of certainty for most human beings, which is a good thing. So let's not start, not for a moment am I prescribing that we need to go back to nature. But let's understand that we have built a completely different world upon the natural environment that we live within. But our bodies are designed to respond to a natural environment. So how do we close this gap is really the question now. Because what happens in this reversal is that once sustaining and protective evolutionary strategies become excessive because they're not being used, and they become the core causes of many emotional disruptive behaviors and diseases of today. So while anxiety is extremely useful for an ape resting on a tree, looking at tall yellow grass below and witnessing black dots in the yellow grass and experiencing anxiety because these black dots don't seem to make sense. And the anxiety causes the ape to figure out what these dots are, and soon that intense curiosity and fear of these unknown black dots makes the ape come up with an answer that the black dots seem to be a leopard, and that anxiety saves the ape's life. But The same black dots on somebody's shirt seen on an Instagram profile would also create unknowingly responses in us. And today we are living in oceans of such triggers. Some of them are good, trigger our smoke alarms. What we don't know is what triggers our smoke alarms in what contexts. Now we are getting closer to the idea of the cognitive gym, right?
I'm following so far. And if I understand, there has been some point in the history of mankind to bring this certainty because they want this. Now you're saying that it is just like in abundance today.
Increasingly for more and more people. The function of civilization is to really shorten the gap between the haves and have-nots, to really ensure that most human beings, ideally all human beings, have access to food, shelter, certainty, longevity, well-being, and dignity of life, right? That is really the purpose of all civilization. That's the purpose of life in general for humans, to strive towards creating a society that is just and certain for all. So in that, yes, we have come a long way. Even within the last century itself, we have made a lot of progress in terms of the number of people who now have access to food, in just terms of human percentage of the species that has greater access to food, greater access to education, greater access to inventing methods of well-being for themselves and their kin. We have come a long way, you know. Slavery has been abolished in most parts of the world. Women have voting rights. In our political technology, in our social technology, in our social contracts, in what is right, what is wrong, in our ethical contracts, we have come a long way. And there is still a long way to go ahead. Everything that we are talking about is towards that aspiration. So addiction to junk food and the emotional responses to art are proofs that stimuli isolation and regrouping into new recipes of dense supernormal stimuli can hack into our fixed action patterns by affecting changes in our hormones and neurotransmitters. I just gave you an example of that. That black dots in a certain environment may mean something to you, and hence trigger your hormones and neurotransmitters to produce a certain kind of behavior which would have saved your life. But the same smoke alarm, if it goes off on a normal day when there is actually nothing to fear, may get debilitating. And that is the reason why we are seeing a rise in anxiety cases, in depression cases in our environment today, because we are really exposed to oceans of stimuli, which are just brute force exposed to us. We are exposed to endless stimuli on a moment to moment basis. Most of it our brain recontextualizes and does not get triggered by, but some of it gets interpreted without a contextual filter. And those may trigger our smoke alarms that have evolved. And when I say smoke alarm is basically any kind of pain or a trigger response or a fixed action pattern response that we have evolved as a species to protect ourselves from danger. So pain is our way of protecting our tissue from tissue damage, right?
Correct.
It's a warning signal. It's a smoke alarm that our body produces to save ourselves from any kind of from an injury to get any deeper, or from losing a limb, or from losing an opportunity to live. Emotional pain, just like pain, is also a smoke alarm which slows us down, which allows us to take stock, which allows us to kind of understand our place in the world around us and to reconfigure our place in the world around us. A loss of a mating partner that causes profound emotional, you know, pain in most of us is our body's way of allowing us to take stock and reconfigure our strategy of living our life ahead, lives ahead. So smoke alarms are our body's way of slowing us down so that we can heal and kick back with resilience.
But what is the need now? Because if there's certainty, you're saying at a micro level, still people are facing those at a day-to-day level?
No. I'm saying that there is no need now in a lot of us. That it's a vestige, it's a residue of a software that evolved in forest and savanna environments. It's a residue of a software that evolved in Stone Age, but it's continued to be used by our bodies in the abundance of space age. So a lot of us who are privileged enough to have sufficient life resources and sufficient access to living life fully still continue to have these smoke alarms. And that is really the cause of, that is really what we call anxiety and depression today. So now the question is, we fix our additional consumption by going to the gym. The calories that our bodies store and gather and accumulate for hunting days that are never going to arise, we use these calories up by going to the gym.
Or maybe just consume less carbs.
That's the second solution, right? So there are two solutions. One is that you consume lesser sugar, so you do not give your body anything to accumulate too much.
Yeah.
Or if you have consumed calories, You use those calories up by creating synthetic physical exercises that are not actually going to result in food. In forest and savanna environments, there is no need to always walking around. You're gathering, you're hunting, you're on the move. And till in pre-agrarian times, and agriculture is only 10,000, 12,000 years old. So in the 240,000 years before that, we were nomadic. We are a nomadic species. We were always on the move from one place to another. Always looking, always hunting for, always looking for food, always looking for safer environments. So our bodies expected to use up these calories, and our bodies hence rewarded the consumption and storage of these calories. So today, we found a simulation. We created a synthetic simulation of all the actions that we used to perform in forest environments. Call this the gym. Similarly, our body is also expecting to use up our hormones in a certain way. Our body is constantly producing hormones in a certain way. Our body is producing emotional behaviors, expecting scarcity, which produces behaviors in us that are better suited for forest and savanna environments. So what's the emotional or cognitive equivalent of a gym is really the question of the cognitive gym. Right? Can we have a simulation of a behavioral simulation that rewires our body and makes it body and mind and makes it right for our modern environments, makes it perfectly suited for our modern environments. I call this set of tools and exercises the cognitive gym.
And it is just a question that you have arrived at, or you're sort of like, is it something which is designed today as we speak?
No, we have been designing this. It's in fact, we have the answer. We do feel that we have at least quite a few answers, and we are moving very, very close towards creating some kind of a application-based solution. At this point, our gym is really a virtual, immersive, gamified environment made by isolating and regrouping recipes of stimuli that actually trigger fixed action behavioral patterns and balance out these imbalances produced by the disparity between our Paleolithic genes and our modern environments. Okay, so while we are shockingly similar to birds and bees, the first significant difference arises from our ability to store a massive amount of new memories in our brains. That's one question that you are asking, right? So life was very different in forests and savannas millions of years ago, right? Predatory threats were high, food was scarce, so were mating opportunities like we established earlier. We are genetically and anatomically the same species that we were 200,000 years ago, more or less. We are still Homo sapiens, and we were Homo sapiens 200,000 years ago, right? Which means our behavior is still guided by the if-then response algorithms that evolved in these environments.
But sorry to interrupt, but I don't know whether I'm making sense, but there's this Daniel Kahneman who talks about two levels in which we operate also. No? One is a short-term thinking, which is more instinctive. And then there is a long-term analysis also. Like, how would you fit those concepts in this? I mean, because what we are talking about is instinct, which is like very, very natural. And you see a lion and you run away, right? But if you take some time to process what is 2 + 2, it will take some time. So how does that fit in?
So that's where the first significant difference arises, which is our difference between our species and every other species, and the difference that we as a modern Homo sapien have with the cave Homo sapien. And that significant difference is the ability to store a massive amount of new memories in our brain, which allows us to retrain and rescale our genetic impulses, which you are calling instinct, and modify our bodies and behavior to a large extent. So we are born with physical and emotional abilities, but as we grow up, we learn when and where to use them and in what proportion. Our genetic personality starts getting layered by modules of memories and their connections formed within our lifetime. The other ability that we have that accumulates exponentially is to augment our strength, skills, memory, and intelligence non-biologically, which is where we use technologies like language. केक आपकी आपका एक जेनेटिक कोड है विच इज विच इज विच इज अ बंच ऑफ वर्ड्स अ बंच ऑफ सेंटेंसेस नॉट नेसेसरली ऑर्डर्ड टू मेक ऑल द मीनिंग इन द वर्ल्ड दैट gets that interacts with the environment the you know through the first 9 months of your birthing stage and then the first 24 months as your you know prefrontal cortex is formed and as you collect the first memories of your life so you keep adding stacks of information stacks of memories upon the genetic memory you have you know the way the interaction between the genetic code that you are born with and the environment causes very specific epigenetic phenotype manifestation yani aapki not only your eye color or hair color or your body shape is guided by that but also a lot of your behaviors are hardwired at that stage so I think the thing is we can go I mean this is an this is a very big subject and we can go very very deep into this but the idea is that there is such a thing as isolating stimuli and regrouping stimuli. By stimuli, I mean it could be visual stimuli, it could be colors, forms, textures, sounds. It could be, you know, it could be all chemical stimuli. It could be smells and fragrances, the things that you touch and feel around you, pressure, all kinds of stimuli. You can isolate them and regroup them to create extremely specific triggers in people. That's really what all these examples tell us.
So I think, Anand, what we'll do is I would assimilate or like just listen to this again and again and try to understand the more subtler aspects because even in case of Ship of Theseus, you have to watch multiple times to understand the multiple layers that you are trying to express. तो ये तो थोड़ा सा और भी हैवी ड्यूटी है तो मे बी आई विल वील वील पार्क दिस फॉर नाउ एंड बिकॉज दिस इज लाइक एन एंडलेस कॉन्वर्जेशन एंड समवन हैज टू रियली फॉलो यू थ्रू एंड थ्रू टू अंडरस्टैंड द न्यूएंसेस ऑफ इट बट एंड होपफुली वी डू लाइक वन मोर एपिसोड टू अंडरस्टैंड द अदर साइड व्हेन द गेम इज रेडी व्हेन थॉट्स आर मैनिफेस्टेड इन टू sort of real actions and real situations. Does that sound good?
Sounds very good. Yeah, I think let's park it aside for later, but let's definitely come back to it in sooner than later, yeah? Suddenly, yahan pe network bahut kharab hai for some reason. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks a lot, Anand, for giving your time. It was like an honor to have you on the show only. Matlab, wohi mere liye kafi badi baat hai. And yeah, we'll schedule something soon.
Sounds great. Sounds fantastic.
Okay, thank you and all the best for your project.
Thank you. Okay, thank you thanks. So much.
So that's it from AudioGAN this year. Do tune into Mubi to watch Anand Gandhi's Continuum, Right Here, Right Now, The Insignificant Man and many other classics and cult favorites. Get a whole month of great cinema for free at Mubi.com. That is MUBI.com/AudioGAN. Thanks for listening till the end and have a great year ahead. Take care. Bye.
And that's it from today's Gyan session. Catch us on iTunes, Saavn, Stitcher or any podcasting app you use. Do rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Stay tuned for more Gyan on audiogyan.com. Till then, bye.